From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis with two journalists, one an Israeli, the other a Jordanian of Palestinian descent. Danny Rubenstein is a columnist and a member of the editorial board for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He lives in Jerusalem. Rami Kori writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World. He's a former editor of the Jordan Times and lives in Oman. The Israeli-Palestinian crisis coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Clinton praised the victims of the USS Cole bombing as patriots who rose to freedom's challenge. He spoke at a memorial ceremony at Virginia's Norfolk Naval Station in honor of the 17 killed aboard the destroyer. The Senate has given final congressional approval to a $78 billion agricultural spending bill that slightly eases the trade embargo with Cuba. The White House says President Clinton will sign the measure. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The measure will allow the sale of grain and medicine to Cuba for the first time in four decades. But backers of easing the embargo say it's mostly a symbolic victory, since the legislation forbids U.S. banks or the government from financing any sales to Havana. The measure also puts into law the travel ban to Cuba, which had been an executive order. Farm state lawmakers who supported lifting the embargo say it's a first step toward a broader opening, but others called it a victory for the hardliners who oppose any trade with the Castro regime. The bill also contains a provision allowing pharmaceutical companies to re-import drugs that are sold more cheaply abroad, but Democrats say the measure is so full of loopholes it will likely mean little, if any, savings for consumers. It also contains $2 billion in emergency assistance to farmers who lost crops because of the drought. Brian Naylor, NPR News, The Capitol.
Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has announced that she will visit North Korea early next week. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Secretary Albright will become the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Pyongyang since the Korean War half a century ago. Her trip is the latest development in a warming trend in U.S.-North Korea relations. The announcement came on Albright's plane as she flew back to Washington from the Middle East and was reported by wire services. She'll leave the United States on Sunday. On Monday and Tuesday, she'll confer with several North Korean officials, including Kim Jong-il, the nation's leader. There are reports that Albright will help plan a visit to North Korea by President Clinton while she's there, but the White House has not confirmed that. After she leaves Pyongyang, Albright will visit Seoul, where she'll brief South Korean and Japanese officials on her trip to the North. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Investigators say it may be months before they find the cause of the crash that killed Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan and two others Monday night. They're back at the scene today in St. Louis. The National Transportation Safety Board, meanwhile, has released details of what the pilot told the control tower in St. Louis. Officials say the pilot, believed to have been the governor's son, Roger Carnahan, said he was having trouble with his artificial horizon that helps judge whether the plane is tilting. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished the day below 10,000 today for the first time since March, but it could have been worse. An early sell-off brought the blue chips down by more than 400 points this morning, but by day's end, the Dow is down only 114 points to close at 99.75. You're listening to NPR News. Vice President Gore warned voters in Iowa today that George W. Bush's Social Security plan would cut benefits to current recipients by more than half or cause the system to go bankrupt in 23 years. For his part, Bush campaigned in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. The state is one of several so-called battleground states. From Wisconsin Public Radio, Mary Jo Wagner reports.
Wisconsin only has 11 electoral votes. Nonetheless, it's considered crucial for Bush to take the state if he wants to win. The independent-minded state has elected a Republican governor many times. But President Clinton won the last two presidential elections, and the state also has two Democratic U.S. senators. Bush spoke before hundreds at an office equipment supply company in Eau Claire and seemed surprised he's doing so well in Governor Tommy Thompson's state.
If you'd have talked to me a year ago and had me and Tommy in a room, and we said we're going to be competitive in Wisconsin with less than 3 weeks to go, they might have looked at us kind of funny, Tommy. but I knew we could be.
Meanwhile, Bush finishes his day in La Crosse, where he'll talk about tax cuts by highlighting a middle-income family with triplets. For NPR News, I'm Mary Jo Wagner in Eau Claire.
A federal appeals court ruled today that the state of Texas does not have to submit a plan detailing how it will improve its children's Medicaid program. Today's ruling by the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans temporarily overturns a federal judge's order that said the state must submit a corrective action plan. That plan is part of an August 14th order that found Texas' children's Medicaid program is inadequate. British passenger trains are facing new speed restrictions while police and rail companies probe the cause of a derailment that killed 4 people and injured 35 yesterday. I'm Frank Stachowiak.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis with two journalists, one Israeli, the other a Jordanian of Palestinian origin. Each is in favor of the peace process. Later in the program, we'll hear from Rami Khoury, who writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World. My first guest, Danny Rubenstein, is a political columnist who's on the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's covered the West Bank and Gaza for the paper and is the author of the book The Mystery of Arafat. Early this morning, we phoned Rubenstein in Jerusalem, where he lives. Yesterday, President Clinton announced that Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat had agreed to a truce at the emergency meeting in Egypt at Sharm el-Sheikh. But violence continued today in the streets of the West Bank and Gaza, leading many people to wonder if Arafat still has the power to influence behavior on the street level. Do you think that Arafat has lost influence among the Palestinian people precisely because he's part of the peace process?
Yes, Arafat lost a lot of his influence because the peace process didn't reach the goal that he promised to his people. He promised to his people about 7 years ago that they will get a Palestinian state, that the economic situation will be much better. He almost promised them paradise, and he didn't fulfill today's situation that we didn't reach any peace agreement. Still, the Palestinian territories are in a bad shape from economic point of view. There is no Palestinian state. There is a lot of limits, a lot of restrictions on the Palestinians themselves. They don't have the freedom of movement from one place to another. The Palestinian and of course the regime, the administration that Arafat created in the territories, is not is not the best one in the world, to say the least.
What do you mean by that, about his regime in the territories?
In that the Arafat administration is quite there's a lot of corruption, nepotism. They accuse the leaders that they steal from the people. They accuse the leaders that they don't have a proper system in their administration. And sometimes they even call it a regime of gangsters, of the mafia, that they use all the connection that only few people benefit from the peace process and become rich, and the most of the people stay in the bad condition that they had before.
Danny Rubenstein, in 1998, you wrote this, more than once it has struck me that all these years I've been writing what is essentially the same article. There is always something about a crisis in the diplomatic process. There is the threat of a renewed outbreak of violence and a steady stream of the same words, terror, settlements, refugees, rights. How many times can I write that the Oslo peace process is dying and that the diplomatic impasse is very dangerous? You say you've been writing this over and over and over again, and it's always the same story. What's been happening in the past few weeks in Israel and the territories, do you see this as a continuation of the same story, or is something different, something more dramatic, more dangerous, more risky?
It's more or less the same, but it's not only that from the time that I started to write my stories. It started years back. From the, let's say, almost 100 years of the conflict here. The problem of the conflict here is that it's a conflict between two communities. It's not a conflict between two states. When you have a conflict between two states, it's a problem of the border. You have to move the border a few meters or kilometers or miles here and there. Here you have a situation in which the conflict is between, it's not between Jerusalem and Damascus, let's say, or between Jerusalem and Cairo. It's a problem between Jerusalem and Jerusalem. In such conflict that you have in many other areas in the world, like in Northern Ireland or in Lebanon or in Cyprus or in former Yugoslavia, that you have in the same country, you have two or more communities. And this nature of dispute is much more, I would say, much more cruel. People use a lot of symbols. And the problem is that you cannot make a total disengagement between the two communities. That's the main problem here.
You have been covering West Bank and Gaza for an Israeli newspaper. So you're familiar with what's happening in the territories, and you're familiar with what's happening in Israel. Do you feel like you see things on each side that you think the other side doesn't understand?
Yeah, that's sometimes it's like a talk between two people who are deaf, because the people don't listen to each other. People see everything differently, and people use different language sometimes. It's the problem is not that they don't understand each other, they don't want to understand each other, they don't want to listen to each other. That's the main issue here. You know, there were many atrocities in this crisis here. Everybody complained that the atrocities were shown on TV more of the atrocities that against his position, it was shown more by the CNN. And the matter of fact, it was the same. You know, I'm talking about picture of the photograph of the child in Gaza, in the hand of his father, dying in the hand of his father, and the picture of the lynch in Ramallah. Both sides complained that the CNN and the other international media show those pictures too much. You know, so it's not they simply cannot see the other side.
One of the Palestinian justifications for the current intifada is that the Israelis have been using disproportionate force. And I'm wondering, from the Israeli point of view, how the use of guns and tanks in Gaza and West Bank is seen. What do the Israelis have to say about the amount of force being used?
I would agree with the Palestinian claim only the beginning, or the first day. On the first day of the clashes, I think that the Jerusalem police overused the force in the Temple Mount. That's what really was the match that put the fire on here. It was, seven people who died in the Temple Mount was a real factor that put this fire, but later the Israelis didn't have any other option. We are talking about small Israeli settlements in the area of Gaza or in the West Bank that were attacked by hundreds or thousands of demonstrators, and if the Israelis would not react with these heavy arms, they would be dead like the lynch that you've seen in Ramallah.
Are there things as a journalist that you most want to explain to Israelis about what life is like for Palestinians in the territories, and things that you'd like Palestinians to understand about Israelis?
What I try to explain to my reader is, for instance, the relationship towards land. For them, for the Palestinians, for the Arabs, land have a different meaning that is for us, because it's an agrarian society. Many of them used to be peasants in the past. Many of them are still peasants and have a deep relation to the land. We don't understand it. For us, we are an urban society. Many of us live in towns, and it's more Western social structure. So we don't have the same attitude towards land that they have. On their side, it's totally different. For them, they don't understand why we came back to this land after 2,000 years. And they would say, you have land and you have your roots in Europe or in some other place, so you can go back to the place that you were born, that you have, if you have any connection to the land, it should be in Europe, in other places. You speak a different language, you are not belong to this area, and so on.
You know a lot of people in the Israeli peace movement, and I'm wondering if you think that people within the peace movement have been affected, if their opinions about peace, if their opinions about negotiating with Arafat and with Palestinians has been changed by the current crisis.
Yeah. Unfortunately, some of them changed their attitude or changed their view about it. I don't justify it. I don't see any. You know, that the problem is not really the problem. The way I see it, it's also that we didn't do the right thing in the past. We didn't dismantle even one settlement since the Oslo Agreement. We were.
You're talking about the Israeli settlements the territories.
We didn't dismantle even one settlement. We kept those settlements, you know, in the middle of Hebron, the middle of Gaza. And we, according to our plan, to this government plan, we were ready to dismantle them and to pull back from many. So why didn't we do it in the past? That's really, I don't understand. You know that the problem is that really what make me, really depressed me, is that today we have the most dovish, the most flexible Israeli government. And in the Arab camp, you have in the Palestinian camp, you have the most, I would say, practical and flexible regime, which is Arafat, compared to the Hamas. It's all relative here. So if those both sides couldn't reach an agreement, and they couldn't reach an agreement in Camp David, the crisis came because I think that this is the basis of the crisis. It's because we discover on both sides that the most flexible position cannot meet together. We cannot agree. The minimum that we, the maximum that we offer, didn't meet the minimum of the Palestinian demands.
So it sounds like you really think the peace process is over for now.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that that's not only my crystal ball, but it's many of us here that for the time being, it's over.
Well, what would that mean? I mean, what would life be like in Gaza and the West Bank and in Israel if the peace process is temporarily over?
There'll be some temporary agreement how to manage the crisis, how to prevent explosions, and how to let the Palestinian Authority going in its way, you know, and governing the Palestinian territories. And with some kind of disengagement of separatism of between both communities. That's the only option that I see now. We need time till the wounds will be somehow recovered. But the wound is very, very deep now, and the mood on both sides is terrible.
Danny Rubenstein is a political columnist who's on the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He lives in Jerusalem. Later in the program, we'll hear from Rami Kouri, who writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World. This is Fresh Air. When we cover issues on Fresh Air, our goal isn't to find guests who will fight with each other. A shouting match can be very dramatic, but it doesn't necessarily clarify the issues. Our ambition is to present thoughtful, reflective conversations in the hope of providing context for the story and clarifying different points of view. That emphasis on clarity and context is what you've come to expect from public radio. So during this fundraiser, in fact, during this break, please call with your financial support. Thank you. Let's get back to the interview we recorded early this morning with Danny Rubenstein, a political columnist and a member of the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. You live in Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem there are Jews and Palestinians in close proximity. Tell me a little bit how life has changed in the past few weeks since this new uprising, how life has changed in Jerusalem.
What really was changed that we don't, you know, we live in a separate quarters. So we don't enter. Arabs don't come, or they come very rarely to the Israeli, to the Jewish quarters. Jews are not going at all to the Arab neighborhoods. And the residential area is really totally separated. So what was changed in my life, for instance, when I have to go to some place which is in East Jerusalem and I have to cross an Arab neighborhood, I will prefer to do some kind of a bypass and not to cross, to cross and not to go through, I'm talking about driving, through an Arab neighborhood. If I'm walking, it's less dangerous. But if I'm driving, everybody can identify me because of many reasons, and they will they can do, you know, they can throw rocks and so on the vehicle. So I changed, for instance, my habits of moving from one place to another, and that's one of the. I don't enter some of the Arab places that I used to go to. Because I feel that the people there are, I don't know if they are hostile. They're not hostile, but they treat me in a different way. They're not so polite, and so they don't welcome me the way that they used to.
Getting back to the Israeli peace movement, what exactly do you think has changed within it? What kinds of changes of heart, if any, are you seeing within the peace movement?
The change in the peace movement is about the nature of the Arab people and the Palestinians. Those who saw the lynching in Ramallah, that was a shock, a real shock, about many of Israelis, because there was dancing in the street there, and people looked happy, and the police officers didn't do anything. So Israelis, the peaceful ones, say, look with whom we are dealing, look who are our partners. And I have to admit that those pictures were such a shock for many of us, because I and many of us visited Ramallah many times. We know this place, we know this downtown Ramallah, we know this police station. And to be inside the police station, and that how the mob, picture how the mob penetrate the area, and the police doesn't do anything. That's really shocked many of us, and it creates, you know, they say, look with whom we are. Look what kind of people we are dealing with.
Was that the reaction you had too?
No, because I know that there are several cases in which the mob control the street. And it happens all over the world. I'm sorry to say that it happened from time to time also here in Israel. It doesn't reach this extent. Nobody can penetrate, you know, or a police station here and do this. But to kill in the street, it happened here and there, also among Israelis. But this kind of incident that happened in Ramallah, I don't believe that it could happen in Israel.
You're on the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Could you talk a little bit about what editorial meetings have been like in figuring out what the editorial position will be on the current conflict?
We consider a liberal newspaper, and our position is mainly, I would say, flexible towards the Arabs. We even wrote an editorial that Israel should give away the mosque, you know, the Temple Mount, to the Palestinian, to the Islamic, and we can live without it. There is a lot of criticism against us now, against the left, against, because they say, you see, we adopt your position. In the editorial board of Haaretz, I would say that more or less we don't agree, but most of the people have the same position, have a liberal position. The problem is in the street. We will call the street. Among the we got a lot of letter to the editor, on both sides, complaining that we were too flexible, that we were too dovish, too moderate. And look what is the Arab response to it, the Palestinian response to it. And we got also other letters from the ultra-left who blamed the Israelis and said, you see, this is the Israelis didn't agree, didn't understand the Palestinian position, didn't want to listen to the Palestinian position. The Israelis continue the occupation all the time. And that's the result of it. So it is a real, gap between the two views.
In its early years, Israel saw itself as a kind of David against the Goliath of the Arab nations. Israel built a very strong military, and now Israel controls the occupied territories. Israel has been using armed force again within the territories and is seen as more of the Goliath rather than the David. What do you think this is doing to the self-image of Israelis?
Well, I'm not so sure that it's true, because the image is something, but there is also some real reality here. In the reality, we are still a small state stuck in the Middle East. As Prime Minister Barak used to say, we are a villa in the jungle, which means that we are really different from this area. We are foreigners here. And from economic and social point of view, we are in the middle of Europe. We are not in the Middle East. The average income in Israel is 10 times more than among the Palestinians, in the Palestinian society, and about 20 times more than in Egypt. So we are really in some situation that is still, we have a problem here. We are still a very tiny, small minority here, 5 million Jews in the ocean of 150 million Arabs. So we are still in the same position. It didn't change.
Danny Rubenstein is a political columnist and a member of the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Coming up, we'll hear from Rami Khoury, who writes a syndicated political column called A View from the Arab World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, reaction in the Arab world to the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. We talk with Rami Khoury, who writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World. He's a former editor of the Jordan Times. We'll be right back.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing its new 2001 lineup with the OnStar communication system. Information available at saabusa.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of 50 Acres and a Poodle, a memoir of love, livestock, and finding myself on a farm by Jean Marie Laskus.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's program, we're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis with two journalists, one Israeli, the other a Jordanian of Palestinian origin. Earlier, we heard from Danny Rubenstein, who's on the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. My guest Rami Khoury writes a syndicated political column called A View from the Arab World. He's also the former editor of the Jordan Times, one of the newspapers which carries his column. We phoned him early this morning in Amman, Jordan, where he lives. Arafat was at the meeting yesterday in which there was an agreement that both sides would try to push for a truce. How much authority or control does Arafat have now to influence the people in West Bank and Gaza?
He has quite a bit of authority and control, but he doesn't have absolute authority. He certainly can make a strong plea, and the people directly under his control, he can tell them to do this or do that. But this is a situation in which people are expressing very strong emotional spontaneous sentiments, the Palestinian people who are demonstrating and resisting confronting the Israeli troops and tanks. Are not doing it because anybody told them to go out in the street and do it. I mean, this is slightly, I think, racist almost on the part of Israelis and Americans who say things like, why does Arafat send the children out, or why doesn't he tell them to stop fighting? Assuming that, you know, Palestinians are like Ottomans, you can turn them on and turn them off. You know, people weren't saying that about the Serbian people in the streets. They weren't saying that about the people who resisted the tyranny in Eastern Europe and Russia and rose up in a spontaneous rebellion. And you have the same situation in Palestine. There are elements who will respond to Arafat and elements who will not.
I think there is an impression that Arafat is now seen as too conciliatory and that he's lost some of his credibility among some of the Palestinian population because he's seen as making concessions with the United States and with Israel. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Yes, there is. He has lost a lot of credibility in recent years. He's a very complex figure. You know, he's sort of a George Washington, sort of gone to the edges. He's widely respected among Palestinians as the person who almost single-handedly led the Palestinian national movement for 30 or 40 years, and he's done an amazing job of not letting the Palestinian issue disappear. At the same time, he has entered into this Oslo peace process that many Palestinians are worried about. They think it's going to leave them with a bunch of little Bantustans and Palestinians on closed reservations separated from each other by Israeli military roads. So there's a lot of concern among many Palestinians about the peace process that Arafat is engaged in. There's also concerns that he is not being as democratic or transparent as we would like him to be, and that there's a lot of corruption and typical third world kind of accusations. But at the same time, he is the, he's, as they say, he's the man. He's the one who does have international legitimacy, does control money and the security forces under him. So he's good and bad at the same time. But the reality is that people negotiating with him do not have the option of choosing who to negotiate with. If the Israelis have a leadership and the Palestinians have a leadership, those are the people that have to be dealt with.
Since the current intifada can lead to a more hardline anti-peace government in Israel, can the intifadas be seen as very counterproductive for the people living in West Bank and Gaza?
No, I don't think that's a fair assessment. The history of the peace process, especially since the Oslo process started in 1993, the history has been that when you get violence or extremism by both sides, whether it's Jewish-Israeli terrorists or Palestinian terrorists or people on the street, and in both cases we've had violence, and it tends to bring the peace talks to a halt for a very brief period of time. It may be a few days, it may be a few weeks. But what it tends to do is reinforce the realization by the majorities on both sides that violence is not an answer, that the answer is to complete the negotiations and to complete the disengagement, to get the Israeli occupation off the backs of the Palestinians, let a Palestinian sovereign state emerge, living peacefully side by side with Israel, and give Israel the recognition and security guarantees that it legitimately requests. So I think the Intifada is very much a powerful expression of the real sentiment and will of the Palestinian people. And remember, they're calling this the Intifada for Independence. This is a bunch of people running around Palestine, Arab Palestinian people, saying basically, give me liberty or give me death. And that should ring bells with American people. These are people who are not fighting because they like to fight. They're fighting because they've sustained the second longest military occupation of the 20th century. Only the Japanese occupation of Korea was longer than the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And I think there is a strong sentiment among Palestinians and all Arabs that we need to get the occupation ended and the emergence of a Palestinian state, living peacefully with an Israeli state.
I'm wondering if this got much reaction in Jordan. A sheikh who is a leader of the Hezbollah, the radical Muslim group, has called on his people to take knives and stab Israelis to death when they come across Israelis. And statements like that, I think it's fair to say, are really fanning anti-Semitic sentiments, not only in the Middle East, but I think that's kind of spreading out to other parts of the world. I'm wondering what kind of reaction those comments got from people in Jordan, if you've heard any reaction to that.
I haven't heard any specific reaction to that specific quotation, but I think it is woefully unfair, both politically, morally, and historically, to take that kind of quotation out of context and just say, well, look what Hezbollah is saying. The sheikh was who said that, didn't say that out of the blue. He said that after, over 100 Palestinians have been killed and the Israelis have used massive military overkill against largely unarmed and largely young Palestinian kids. So we're involved in a war, and in a war situation, this is what people say. There are certainly people in the Arab world who will go around saying that we need to, you know, perpetually fight the Israelis and never live with them, as there are people in Israel who are saying that the Arabs only understand force and we have to keep killing Arabs. I heard somebody on Israeli TV, a young Israeli man, saying we have to keep killing the Arabs until they understand that this is our land and they have to live with us on our land. So both sides are doing terrible things, and neither of these actions that are being done by both sides, the lynchings, the burnings, the racist, the violence, none of this can be justified in any way. But what you're dealing with is the result of a mob psychology in a context of warfare on the ground, in the larger context of two people, the Jewish people and the Israeli people and the Palestinian people, who have had traumatic modern histories of different kinds. The Jewish experience in history is rather more traumatic, perhaps, on a longer scale in intensity than the Palestinian one. But the result is, in the end, today you have Israelis who are worried about their future existence in what they consider to be their country in Israel, and we're telling them, we will live with you in your country in Israel if you also live with a Palestinian state. And the Palestinians are concerned about their survival in what they consider to be their own country in Palestine. These are two people who are existentially traumatized by the prospects of not being able to know if their children are going to be able to live in this land, or if they're even going to be able to wake up tomorrow and find themselves alive or dead. I mean, these are really difficult psychological perceptions that you have on both sides. And in this context, you're going to get outrageous statements being made by people. And I think you have to weigh those statements very carefully.
My guest is Rami Khoury. He writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World, and he's the former editor of the Jordan Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Rami Khoury is my guest. He's joining us by phone from Amman, Jordan. He writes a syndicated weekly political column called A View from the Arab World. He's a former editor of the Jordan Times. I think that some Israelis and other people around the world wonder if there are Arab states that still want to try to get rid of Israel, that still haven't accepted Israel and would like to see the end of Israel.
Well, probably to the same extent that there are people in the United States who would like to get rid of the People's Republic of China. You know, you have an official relationship with the People's Republic of China and trade and ambassadors, but there's a lot of Americans who refuse to talk to Chinese, who think it's a terrible autocratic government that runs labor camps and sweatshops and whatever. So, yes, there are people, of course, in the Arab world who say, look, we can never live in peace with an Israeli state because they've taken the land of Palestine and whatever. But these are almost certainly a small minority, like there is a small minority of Americans who don't want to, you know, coexist with the government in Beijing. The majority of Arabs have clearly stated that they would be perfectly happy to live alongside an Israeli state, but only on the condition that Israel also accepts to live alongside a Palestinian state and find an acceptable and fair resolution to the Palestine refugee issue. I mean, the problem between the Arabs and Israel is not one of perceptions that because they're Jews or we're Arabs or we're Christians and Muslims or they're Jews or whatever. It's not an ideological problem. It's a real problem of human life and dignity and survival. There's now about 7 million Palestinians, of whom around 4 million are living outside of Palestine, and they feel they were thrown out of their homes in Palestine, like the people were thrown out of Kosovo by Milosevic, and they want to go back, like the people want to go back to Bosnia, and the Americans, with the Dayton Agreement and the war in Serbia, are insisting that refugees must go back to their countries. Well, Palestinians are saying they have that same right, too, enshrined in UN resolutions, and we need to solve that problem. Now, obviously, not all 4 or 5 million Palestinian refugees are going to go back to Israel, but some fair resolution of the problem needs to be done, and this is why we still have this fighting going on in Palestine this week. And the intensity of the international diplomacy that was brought to bear to bring about the Sharm el-Sheikh summit, I thought, was pretty impressive. I mean, I can't remember any situation in the last 40, 50 years when you had so many top world powers and leaders personally getting involved in trying to mediate in what is a rather small little territorial dispute in a little corner of the world. But obviously the impact of this little dispute reverberates on the oil markets, on the stock markets, in security issues, in terms of violence against Arabs and Israelis and Jews around the world. So it's an issue that needs to be addressed more diligently, more equitably. And I think the majority of people in the Arab world certainly are willing to live with Israel, as the majority of Israelis now say they're willing to live with a Palestinian state. We just have to finish that negotiating process to bring about the reality of an Israeli and a Palestinian state living side by side with equal rights.
You are a syndicated political columnist. You write a column called A View from the Arab World. You also host a TV program. How do you see your job? How do you see your role, your importance as a journalist in crisis times like this?
Well, that's a good question because it's a question I have to grapple with all the time. And in the last couple of weeks, it's been fascinating for me and also very difficult because I see my role as both expressing the views of my people and my society, which is Jordan and Palestine. I'm a Jordanian national of Palestinian origin, and I see myself as a binational. I see myself as a Jordanian and a Palestinian national at the same time. And I see my job as partly to manifest the sentiments that people feel and to express them in ways that can be communicated to a global audience, because I write in English. And also, I see my job partly, though, as stepping back a little bit from the fray of day-to-day events and the emotional pressures and trying to look at more constructive means of how do we get out of this maelstrom of emotion and violence and tension. I don't want to just fuel the flames of emotionalism and violence, but rather to analyze why this is happening and to suggest ways it could be changed. And just today, my column my weekly column, I suggest the ideas that both Israelis and Palestinians could do to cool down the tensions and the rhetoric and to try to get the process back. And I'm hoping that this column I wrote today, I expect it to be published in Israel so more and more Israelis can see it. And of course, on the internet, people can see it too. But I see my job as both being an advocate of my own political culture, but and also being somebody who tries to promote reconciliation between my culture and the people with whom we have a conflict, who are the Israeli people.
So what are a couple of the suggestions you make to Palestinians and Israelis in your in today's column?
Well, the first one is not to use the mass media as a means of dehumanizing the other. I mean, seeing the Palestinian and Israeli leaders on CNN calling each other's names really is pretty pathetic, I think. I mean, both sides really should be ashamed. This is, the mass media, CNN and Al Jazeera and BBC and the various Arab satellite stations and whatever, are very good for selling dog food advertising or for entertaining people, but they're not very good as a tool of conflict resolution. So they should cool down this rhetoric on the global airwaves. The second thing is they should stop using ultimata and threats and setting these preconditions and realize that these kinds of conflicts only get resolved when both sides simultaneously and mutually take those steps that must be taken to tone down the level of the rhetoric and bring down the level of the actual violence and confrontations at the street level. A third thing they can do is to understand the lessons of what happened. I mean, the Israelis need to be much more sensitive now in retrospect to what the Al-Haram al-Sharif, or the Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, which are built on the area that the Jews, the Israelis, know as their Temple Mount. The Israelis should be much more sensitive now to what this site means to Palestinians and to Arabs and to Christians and Muslims, that this site, the place where Sharon went in September 28th that sparked the violence, this is not just a normal religious site. This is the most dramatic symbol of national identity for the Palestinian people and one of the holiest religious symbols for people, for Muslims all over the world. So Israelis need to be more sensitive to that, and people on the Palestinian and Arab side, for instance, need to be more sensitive to the things that are really important to the Israelis. For instance, one of the things I've learned recently is that how important it is for Israelis that incitement, what they call incitement against Israel in the mass media and the textbooks, these things are really, really important to the Israelis, and we need to be sensitive to that. And to hear what they're telling us, and they need to be more sensitive to what we're saying and to hear what we're telling them. So these are some of the ideas that I've been suggesting. And another one is that we need to look at the bigger picture. I mean, okay, there's kids with stones and Israelis with machine guns killing each other at certain junctions in a few places in Palestine and Israel. The bigger picture is that we can stop this by ensuring that we have sovereign Israeli and Palestinian states living side by side with completely equal rights. We can't have a resolution of this problem that requires the Palestinians, first of all, to go back to their homes and to make statements that that give Israel everything that Israel wants, and only then will the Israelis do things that respond to Palestinian rights. This is a conflict of two people who see themselves as states, as nations, as national communities that want and deserve to manifest their identity in sovereign states.
Rami Khoury writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World and is former editor of the Jordan Times. He spoke to us early today from Amman, Jordan. This is Fresh Air. Today we've discussed the Israeli-Palestinian crisis with two journalists, one an Israeli, the other a Jordanian of Palestinian origin. During times of national or international crisis, public radio becomes particularly important for its in-depth news and reflective analysis. I hope you'll support your station now with a pledge. Thank you. Rami Khoury is my guest. He writes a syndicated weekly political column called A View from the Arab World. He's a former editor at the Jordan Times. He's based in Amman, Jordan, and he's speaking to us from Amman by phone. Palestinians who think that Arafat have been too conciliatory seem to be turning toward more radical groups like the Hezbollah. And I'm wondering if there's concern in other Arab countries, in your country of Jordan, for instance, that if Hezbollah becomes more powerful in Gaza or the West Bank, that its power will gain in other countries as well. And what would the reaction in those countries be?
I think there is a danger that the militant groups would become much more popular, but I think it would also be a rather natural occurrence in a way. If the people who are advocating peaceful resolution and negotiations and coexistence are unable to stop the deterioration of the Palestinian condition under Israeli occupation, if the Palestinians find that trying to make peace, as Arafat has done, is not ending the occupation, is not ending the destruction of Palestinian houses or the uprooting of Palestinian olive trees and the killing of children that's going on, if people are still going to keep suffering in Palestine, then at some point people are going to say, hey, this isn't working. And what is working, they look around, they find out that the Israelis unilaterally withdrew with their tail between their feet in Lebanon, in South Lebanon, in the middle of the night, because Hezbollah was attacking them militarily. And many people will say, look, maybe the only way to get the Israelis to withdraw is to attack them militarily. So this is and the Jews, the Zionists, the Israeli groups themselves used it in the 40s against the British and against the Arabs to sow terror and to create mayhem and to get their independent Israeli state. So there is a historical legitimacy to armed struggle up to a certain extent. But today what you're seeing is people insisting, still trying to resolve this problem through political negotiation, peaceful negotiations. But if it doesn't work, at some point they will look to Hezbollah and Hamas and other groups who use bombing and military means, and they will follow their lead to an extent. And this is something that we've seen in the last 2-3 weeks. If you look around, you see rallies all over the Arab world, and more people are holding up pictures of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese group. It's not a Palestinian group. And the supreme irony is that Hezbollah and Hamas did not exist, 20 years ago. These groups were formed to fight the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and South Lebanon. These were groups that were created as a byproduct of the Israeli occupation.
You live in Jordan, and Jordan has a large population of Jordanian citizens of Palestinian descent and of Palestinian refugees, many of whom are in refugee camps in Jordan. King Abdullah was at the conference at Sharm el-Sheikh. What is his position now on the current clashes?
Well, Jordan has had a pretty consistent position on the issue of Palestine for many years. I mean, Jordan as a country consistently says that it supports the Palestinian cause. It criticizes Israel, blames Israel for the violence and the problems that are taking place now. It wants Israel to withdraw from all the occupied territories according to UN resolutions and live with a Palestinian sovereign state next door, with Jerusalem as the capital of both Israel and Palestine. So there's been a pretty clear, consistent Jordanian position supporting these Palestinian demands and rights. The longer-term issue is, what are the implications for Jordan when you get a Palestinian state emerging, living side by side with Israel? Because you might get a lot of Palestinians leaving here. Jordanian citizens who are Palestinian in origin might go to Palestine. They might send their money there. Foreign aid might decline to Jordan if it's a peaceful region and Jordan is not seen to be needing so much foreign aid anymore. There's many, many implications on the economic, the national identity level, the political stability level, and these are issues that Jordan is interested in discussing and wants to be involved in the final status negotiations between Palestine and Israel, because it's really important and legitimate national interests are involved here, and it has a right to make sure that it can protect its national interests.
King Abdullah is one of several leaders in Arab countries now who is of a younger generation. There's also a younger leader now in Syria, Morocco. Do you think that there's any fundamental differences that the younger generations are bringing to their leadership styles and to what they consider to be their main concerns?
I think there is a difference with the younger generation, but I don't know if it's the generation itself that's bringing about the difference or if it's just the fact that these young leaders took over at a moment when most of their countries were experiencing really serious political and economic and environmental and population stresses and other kinds of internal problems. The need to liberalize politically is something that many of them feel. The need to keep undertaking severe economic adjustment is something that everybody is having to live with. Environmental concerns have to be addressed, especially water and arable land. Population pressures, and just adjusting to the new parameters of both a global economy and also a region that is changing, because some people now have, like us in Egypt, have relations with Israel. We can trade, we can travel, we can do business. So all of these things simultaneously are forcing almost all of the countries in the region to come to terms with these new domestic, regional, and global realities. Even some of the countries that haven't had young leaders are having to do the same thing. If you look at a place like Tunisia or Egypt or other places in the region, Oman, they're all, to different degrees, doing similar things. So it's not just the fact that these are young leaders that is the reason for the change. The change is a structural response to really serious, almost existential challenges that almost all of the Arab countries are facing.
Rami Khoury writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World. He spoke to us early this morning from Amman, Jordan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Amy Salat, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross, and this is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with NPR's Scott Simon, sports fan, Quaker, war correspondent, and the son of a comic. He has a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.